We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, 90.9 FM HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could be with us today. Julia Savakul is a writer and a veteran editor for women's magazines. She's our guest this afternoon. Anyway, in her capacity as an editor and writer, she's given a lot of thought to the meaning of the size and shape of women. She says a woman's body size and shape have become her most obvious display of financial and social status. On the program today, we'll take a look at women's bodies as a lens through which to examine cultural identity and global change. It is the subject of Julia Savakul's book, The World Has Curves, The Global Quest for the Perfect Body. Julia Savakul is our guest this afternoon. And listeners, I invite you to join our discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to hearing from you. You may join us with a telephone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Julia Savakul is the articles director for Fitness Magazine. She has also worked for Marie Claire, Good Housekeeping, and Self. She's also had work published in many other publications, including the New York Times, Red Book, and Glamour. Her book, The World Has Curves, The Global Quest for the Perfect Body, is published by Rodale. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455, by email will-talk@illinois.edu. Julia Savakul, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's going to be fun.
This book grew out of a feature you wrote a few years ago for Marie Claire about the ways in which women's body shapes have changed around the world over the last 200 years, and readers loved it. Why do you think readers embraced it so?
I think, you know, largely because we're, as Americans, we all come from somewhere and we all have different genetic makeups and different looks, and we're curious about why we look the way we do. You know, it's America is a culture of thinness, but from our heritage, not all of us can fit that mold. And so I think a story that addressed, you know, how women around the world think about their body and their body shape and what's desirable was somewhat reassuring and also just fascinating to the readers.
Yeah. Did you watch the Academy Awards on Sunday?
Yeah.
Yeah. What were your thoughts about the women who took their turn on the red carpet Sunday?
Well, gosh, I mean, you know, the vast majority of them all look very similar in terms of their shape and their size, and they sort of fit a Hollywood mold that's kind of our stereotypical idea of beauty and glamour. And, of course, you know, there were a few notable exceptions of women who were much bigger than that, and I think that that's it's encouraging. But, I don't see our culture having a phenomenal shift towards that end of the sizing charts anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, we're told the perfect body is the goal, and many women are driven to try and achieve that goal. What is that ideal perfect body in the United States today?
Well, I think in the U.S., it's, you know, it's undeniably a thin shape, tall, thin, Barbie-esque. But I think there has been a small shift in the last maybe 5 years or so, 5-10 years, towards a fitter looking shape than just the kind of waifish, emaciated look of the Kate Moss's in the 90s. I think that we've kind of moved past that, at least for the moment. I mean, I think the pendulum goes back and forth, certainly. But I think shows like The Biggest Loser, some of the other kind of popular body makeover shows that we see on TV now are emphasizing being fit as much as they are emphasizing being thin. So, you know, that's somewhat positive, I think.
Yeah. Among the illustrations in your book, you've included a 17th century painting by Rubens, The Three Graces. Did Rubens like Rubenesque women, or was that the perfect body of the time?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, right? The literature actually suggests that he himself thought that these body shapes were they were unusual, they were unique. I don't think that they are an immediate reflection of the preferences of the time. I think they're a reflection of the artist, but I also think that showing a, you know, being very fleshy, voluptuous, I mean, that was a sign of wealth and prosperity, among other things, you know, in that time frame in Europe, that people with money were able to eat, and if you were able to eat, you were bigger. So, you know, I think that that is tied into it, but I don't think it would be fair to say simply by looking at his work that that was a, you know, a replica of what people thought was the most attractive body shape during that era.
That the women that are portrayed in that painting are look very soft to me, and I would suspect that that was once upon a time also a sign of femininity.
Femininity, and again, I think a sign of the sort of the leisure class. We don't have to do work. We don't do any manual labor, so we don't have tans from being out in the field. We keep our skin white. We keep our skin soft and supple. Yes, because of the being, you know, feminine and delicate, but also because it shows that, you know, we can lounge around all day and not have to flex our muscles, so to speak.
Yeah, lounge around in the sun.
Or, you know, for that time period, lounge around in the shade with the parasol.
Yeah, I think you put it this way at one point in the book. We've gone from pale and pudgy to thin and trim.
Yeah, or tan and trim.
Tan and trim, yeah.
It's, you know, yeah, it's exactly the opposite now in Western culture where to show that you are tan, I mean, that implies that you've got time to lie around in the sun, whereas, you know, 300 years ago, 250 years ago, that simply being tan simply implied you were working in the fields. So you had to be out in the sun, so you didn't have the option of, you know, being indoors. And the poorer people, you know, when we were farmers, when we were agriculturalists that had to work in the fields, had to do manual labor in the factories in the 1800s, that, again, you're going to have more trimmed, toned bodies simply because you're burning energy all day long in order to make a living, whereas now the opposite is true. Most of us have sedentary desk jobs, so those who are, you know, trim and toned are actually having the time and the money to spend in a gym, or, you know, that's the perception anyways, to get that body.
Yeah. Well, now, two-thirds of Americans are overweight, so what does that say about us?
Well, it's funny, right, because we've got these two extremes going on. The reality of it is that we keep getting bigger and bigger as a society, and yet our preference for body size keeps getting smaller and smaller as far as what we see on the TV, what we see in the movies and the magazines. And I think in some ways we are trying to compensate for the reality of our lives with this unachievable ideal. I think it's not an accident that we're choosing, you know, the ideal to be something quite opposite from what we are. It also, I think, is setting us up to say those who can achieve it are of a special group. They are, you know, they're elite in their ability to get this body, and we always seem to want what we don't have. If we were a society of skinny, emaciated people, you know, I would think that our preference, you know, for body shape would be quite plumper.
In the course of your research, you looked into cultural attitudes in the United States toward people who are overweight. What did you learn?
Well, that's the other interesting thing. You know, it's kind of the American work ethic and idea of hard work and discipline, and all these things are kind of ingrained in our somewhat puritanical history. The idea of being overweight connotates lazy or undisciplined, sloppy, unmotivated, dumb. All these kinds of ideas that have nothing to do with the physical, you know, body itself are tied into our perception of someone who isn't taking care of themselves. We very much think that hard work and discipline will get you towards the ideal that we've set up for ourselves. And so, by default, when you are exhibiting the opposite, embodying the opposite look, you also must be embodying the opposite personal characteristics as well.
Mm. How does the goal of the ideal body, how is it set? How does it get formed, and why do we embrace it?
Well, I think, certainly, you take it culture by culture. In our culture, I think it's set somewhat by the media. But I kind of, in my book, sort of rejecting the idea that you can just point the finger and say, it's the media's fault, or it's, the male population's fault that they're, setting women up to, to suppress them or to hold them back. I think that women buy into this idea of what our bodies should look like, and we perpetuate it. I think it's, in some ways, it's a competition among ourselves. It's also, I think, a way to measure, discipline, hard work, success. I think it's hard to isolate simply one variable that is that is the source of our body ideal, but they all kind of work together to create what we have today.
And why do we set the bar so high?
Well, the idea of an ideal, right, is it's something that only a few are going to achieve. It's a very special thing to get. If it was readily available to everybody, it would feel commonplace, and it would lose its luster. It would lose its appeal as something to strive for. If everybody could have a fancy sports cars wouldn't be able to be sold for so much money because, I have sort of that whole kind of mass market versus the boutique kind of couture look in fashion.
Yeah. I remember as kids we said, well, you know what, these twos in the deck of cards, they're not worth anything. Let's get rid of them. Well, then the three was the new two.
It's exactly it. That's exactly it. We are constantly wanting that thing that's rare and hard to get, whether it's because it's so expensive or because it, its existence in nature is so freakish or for whatever reason that, that thing that only a few can attain becomes the thing that everybody wants, but once everybody can get it, it's no longer so special.
Hmm. When and how did the pursuit of the perfect body become focused on women?
And it's interesting because back in Greek times, there are actually very few, nude portraits of women, sort of detailed women's bodies or on the vases or in sculpture. They're almost exclusively focused on men or young men or boys. And at that time, in many of the Greek writings, the perfect body for their culture was described very specifically towards what men should look like. And somewhere it seems like around, it's in Western culture again, the 12th, 13th century, fashion started to change, and the emphasis was more on the women's physique, and I think that played a role in the change in emphasis on what was considered attractive for a woman. But it hasn't always been that way, and I thought that in my research that was quite fascinating.
Yeah. Well, thinking back to the Academy Awards ceremony and the red carpet, there's so much difference between the world of fashion for women and men. The men all look pretty much cut of the same cloth, and the women all kind of different fashion statements there.
Yeah, and I think, from researching some of the Renaissance artists and the kinds of thinking as far as what they were going to pursue in their works, the curves, the way the light plays off the female body is much more interesting to them, they say, than the more two-dimensional male physique. That there is just a more sensual body to paint, to explore on canvas, and I think that probably could be extrapolated from into everyday life as well, that, you know, I mean, not to be biased here, but I think, you know, the female body is in many ways much more interesting than what you have with men, which is a somewhat straight up and down silhouette.
Mm-hmm. You, back to the idea of men and women and the focus now on women. You write about Naomi Wolf and her 1991 thesis on beauty, the beauty myth. And she put it in political terms, calling beauty a currency system, keeping male dominance intact. Now, that was 1991. What do you think? Was she right? Is she right?
I don't think so. I think that, it's a bit of a trap to fall into to look for other people as the reason that we have this obsession with our bodies. I believe that this, certainly that men have played a role, obviously, in shaping what we think of as attractive. But, I think women are playing this game with each other. And it's a sign to us of not only do we have the great career and the perfect house and terrific kids, but we also have a wonderful body because we've worked so hard and juggled all these pieces and put it all together. I honestly believe that women are more critical of other women's bodies than men are of women's bodies. I balk a little bit at the idea that it's something that is being generated and perpetuated solely by men.
Yeah. Also, I think it's interesting if you think about people who have made it their life's work to look into our behavior as consumers, that women shop differently than men do, and we're interested in how things feel and look, and we shop differently. We look at clothing differently, mm-hmm. and we really enjoy that. I think probably it's a generalization, of course, but I think women enjoy fashion or dressing, and they enjoy putting something on that makes them look good.
Yeah, no, I agree. And again, I think that is probably, I am not speaking based on research here, but my gut tells me that is something instinctively female, that we have more of an appreciation for color, texture, feel, both, how something drapes on us than men do. It's a hobby. It's a pleasure. It's not, something that's put upon us to have to do.
And, when you put something on and it feels good and it looks good, it's wonderful.
Right.
Right?
Yes, on the rare occasion you actually find what you're looking for when you go shopping. It's a great feeling. It's like you've won the treasure hunt.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Julia Savakul. She is the author of The World Has Curves, The Global Quest for the Perfect Body. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, or by email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a telephone call from a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, you had mentioned the so-called red carpet, and I was just sort of flipping around, and I saw a little of that, and, they always have that on. I don't know your reaction. My reaction was that this red carpet phenomena is really sort of a softcore pornography is what's going on there. Hmm. And, mostly TNA and hardly anything on there. And it really raised, to my mind, the writings of Professor Catherine MacKinnon that pornography is a form of violence against women, and it's really a human rights matter, not so much a First Amendment matter. And I was wondering what, if anything, you might think about that. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon.
From my perspective, I just think nobody is forcing these women to walk the red carpet, to dress in dresses like that on the red carpet. They're making bundles of money off of you know, their, yes, their acting skills, but they're also their Hollywood personas. I feel like at some point we need to stop pointing fingers and saying women are being victimized by being shooed into a certain mold or having to look a certain way or dress a certain way. I mean, women are, these are grown, thinking, educated women who are making a choice. I have a hard time feeling sympathetic that they are, you know, being put upon to walk the red carpet in these dresses.
And in a moment, we can talk about money in China and beauty. But let's take another call. This is from a listener in Indiana on line 4. Hi.
Hello. When you first started talking, my question was going to be, do women dress for themselves or for men? And I think you've answered that question rather quickly and easily and actually very nicely. I find the thing I find interesting about this sort of thing is that I have a particular kind of body that I have found over the years in terms of dating stuff, I seem to am gravitated towards, attracted to more than others. And I find the thin body rather peculiar. And I know there were periods just recently where the thin body, in a sense, is supposed to be a form of some kind of transfer for men's homosexuality from the young boy you were talking about in terms of the Greeks, what the best body was. I can understand all that, but I think I'd go sort of go along with her thing about if you find something that looks good and you put it on and it feels good, that's beautiful. And that's how I see these girls walking down the red runway. They only have a couple of years to do it because the stakes are very high and the bar is extremely, extremely high. And that first wrinkle means, oh, God, here we go. I'm going to lose it all now. That sort of thing is more sociological to me than psychological. And I sure am glad to hear a woman say that it's not us guys doing all this. I used to date a girl, and she'd find things that happened in 1839 and stuff like that and be yelling at me about how us guys were. And I didn't know how to answer that sort of thing. And I'm sure glad I found one that knows how to answer that sort of thing. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. And Julia Savakul, you want to comment on the listener's comments?
Well, I mean, I appreciate them. I'm not saying that men don't play a role, and I'm not saying that media doesn't play a role. I think there are many cooks in the kitchen when it comes to figuring out, you know, what our ideal body is. But I think that for this generation of women, for young women, it's a choice and often a happy choice to want to look a certain way, to want to take care of ourselves, be fit, be in shape, and it's you know, we do it as much for competition among ourselves as we do, you know, to look good for a potential mate. It's it's hard to, you know, compartmentalize each one of these influences. You know, I think they all sort of weave together. But yeah, and I do think that this is it's a choice. And in this day and age, we need to stop thinking that women are being victimized when they want to show off a great-looking figure.
Hmm. How does our ideal here in the United States differ from the ideal in other places, in other cultures around the world?
Right. Well, you know, in the book, I sort of tried to find places where there are very strong influences that shape what a woman's body ideal is. And so, for instance, in a country like South Africa, where there is a severe AIDS epidemic and a history of health issues in the country, among the African population, among the black population, the plumper, rounder physique is seen as a sign of good health. Secondarily, a sign of prosperity, that there's, you know, money and food to be had. But thin women in South Africa are viewed warily. One of the young women I interviewed lost both her parents to AIDS. She was an AIDS orphan, and she herself was a naturally thin girl and endured incredible poking fun at and being ostracized in her community because people were so afraid that she too had the disease. so health issues in a country certainly play a role in shaping what is considered ideal.
And we have an email question this afternoon from a listener. A couple of questions. Do women who have achieved the Western ideal rest once they've achieved it? Are they ever satisfied? Further, please talk about aging and change in metabolism, body shape in women as it pertains to the ideal in the current culture.
I don't think we rest. I don't think it's the nature of people and certainly not the nature of Western culture to be satisfied with what you have. We always want the next thing, and that's true whether it's the house, the bigger house, the job, the better title, the nicer car, the better behaved kids. Every time you've reached a certain level, a certain plateau, I think it's human nature to want to strive to reach the next level, and that's by and large a healthy a healthy thing. I think it keeps us as a society moving forward and evolving and inventing new things, creating new things. But I think with your body, that can be taken too far. And so if you're never satisfied with the shape that you're living inside of, I think certainly that can start to have a detrimental effect on your self-esteem, on your self-confidence. But on the other hand, I think it could be channeled positively into, so let me get to the gym today. Let me, take that walk around the block. It can keep you moving forward in a positive way, but I think, and often with adolescents, it is used against yourself.
Oh. And aging and change.
I didn't look at that particularly with the book, other than I interviewed women of two different generations for each country and culture that we visited, and you can see that the younger women certainly have a more acute awareness of their bodies, their body shape, what they want it to look like, and that as women get older, and this is a big generalization, but it seems like we tend to mellow and maybe cut ourselves a little more slack and realize there are other ways in which to measure our worth, our contribution to family and society. But certainly in Western culture, I think we're particularly harsh on women as they age and not being able to fit into this mold that we've sort of idealized for the 20 and 30 something year olds. But I don't have a solution to that. It's just an observation.
I wonder if that will change or is changing as we're growing older as a population demographically.
Well, right. That is interesting. I mean, as we sort of have this very large number now of 60-year-olds that are financially in good shape and are able to purchase things to make themselves feel good about how they look, I think, somewhat catering more to that audience. But I still think we're largely a youth-oriented culture.
Let's take another call now, a listener in Urbana waiting for us on line one. Hello.
Hi there. Thanks for the program today. I guess my comments and questions would be a little bit more on technical lines. And you keep referring to sort of like the Western ideal. I'm curious to see what you have to say about sort of the fashion industry. I'm thinking clothes used to have less, sets of clothes. People would have like one or maybe two suits at the most, 100 years ago. But those suits were better quality and they fit better. And, this day and age, it seems like, in America, it's more about consumption of brand names and more numbers of clothes as opposed to, like, the quality of clothes. I mean, I like to spend, probably four times more money than the average person does for whatever I'm buying, but I probably buy, 20 times fewer garments. And I've noticed it's very hard to get something that I'm taller, something that fits me well. It seems like they have this mold of what the American person looks like, and they just crank that out because they're going more for volume. I don't think they do that so much in Europe. I've known a couple of Europeans, one I worked with, and it was an office setting, and she bought clothes once a year, and she probably had about five or six really nice ensembles, and she would wear them, so you'd see them all the time. But it was never a problem because they were always looked great on her, and they were always clean and stuff. Whereas there was another person in the office, you never saw her in the same thing. So I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Okay, that's an interesting question.
Yeah, I did not look at fashion per se in the purchasing of clothing. The book was more focused on our ideas about our body, the body itself. But certainly Americans are over consumers of most things, including food. Fashion, I think you're right. I think that labels mean a lot to us. The more articles of clothing we have that have a certain brand name in them, the higher our status, or the higher we believe our status to be in society. I can't really comment on what they do or don't do in Europe, but I certainly think it's an interesting observation that we seem to choose quantity over quality in this country, and that's a way of, the big pile of stuff that we have is a way of establishing ourselves among our peers. I would wonder, with the current economic climate, if that is changing somewhat, perhaps the thinking is going a little bit back to being more frugal and choosing that one thing we really want as opposed to the five that we kind of want, but there's five instead of one, so aren't we better now? I think that the economic environment may have somewhat of an influence on that situation, but again, that's more just anecdotal. I don't have any data for that at the moment.
Does the listener want to follow up? No. Okay. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Here we are in these really tough times. And this goes back, I guess, to the question that was asked by the person who sent us an email question. Are we ever satisfied? And I think a lot of people today are asking, what really makes us happy?
Sure.
And so with that in mind, in times of economic hardship, how does the pursuit of looking good change?
I think it only grows stronger in the sense of focusing on our body and taking care of our body and our idea, anyways, of what a good body is. Because you might have lost your job, you might have had to cut back on, nights out or going on vacations. But at the end of the day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you're still living inside of this this shell. This is still the thing that represents you, and really the only thing that you can control to a certain extent. And you may not be able to afford the fancy gym membership or be able to afford the great new pair of jeans or whatever it is that your friends have, but you can still work on taking care of your body. You can still work on molding it into what you perceive to be attractive. And I think there's a satisfaction in that, and I think it's one of the reasons in my business you see the health and fitness magazines doing relatively well compared to the luxury fashion magazines, because people still want to know how to take care of their body, where they may no longer have the means to purchase the items to dress it up with.
Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign. Hi, line one.
Hi there. I remember reading years ago about something called the hip to or waist to breast ratio, or hip to breast ratio, that really our estimation of beauty hasn't changed that much. It's a ratio of, I believe, the size of the hips to the size of the breast, and then it was related to fertility. Did you run across any of that?
Yeah. There's a whole kind of line of thinking with evolutionary psychologists about the origins of what it's based on what men find attractive in women, and the idea of proportion and breast to waist to hip ratios, and something called the golden ratio, which includes the face and the dimensions of the face and symmetry, all these things that if you try to break down human anatomy into scientific figures statistically seem to be true, that there's a ideal ratio between all these things. But that's Western culture, and that's not necessarily carried over into other cultures. And I think that's an interesting realization, because you would think that if it's an absolute, it would be universal, and it's not. It's something that's very particular to European culture.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit here. This would be interesting to talk about now, Jamaica and the Coca-Cola body.
Sure. Jamaica was a fun country to explore. There's a real focus there on music and dance, especially among the younger people. And they have a very sensuous, sexual style of dancing in their nightclubs, dance halls, as they call them. And a lot of it has to do with the gyration of the hips and sort of rubbing against each other, men and women, as they move, as kind of a way to court each other in a social setting. And for that reason, you could see why a bony, skinny body type is impractical. Ideal is impractical. It's unattractive. And in fact, the focus in Jamaica is on having very curvy hips, a very round bottom. And when Coca-Cola, back in the 1920s and 30s, they came out with their glass bottle shape and started exporting it to other countries, Jamaica was one of the first countries to begin importing these bottles and sort of becoming a pop culture thing among the younger people. And that old-fashioned Coca-Cola glass bottle shape with a curve, sort of small curve on top, and then narrow middle, and then that wide bottom, it became ingrained in their culture as a symbol of used as a term for the ideal female body shape. She's got a Coca-Cola body, and several of the reggae artists picked that up, and even in some of the songs today that reference will be made, which is just kind of an interesting idea. But their ideal is very much reflects that wider bottom, tapered middle, and then, breasts on top, with the real emphasis being on the hips and the bottom.
What can American women learn from the aesthetic values of women elsewhere in the world, say, women in Jamaica?
I think, that everybody and everybody is different. I think that there's an appreciation in Jamaican culture that we could really benefit from, where they cut themselves a lot more slack if they're not, the exact dimensions that this magazine picture says that they should be. They're going to throw on a tighter skirt and plump it up, and that's going to be okay for them. There's much more relaxed attitude I found towards achieving their body ideal. But I think it's just fun to see that what we think is beautiful is not necessarily what another culture thinks is beautiful, and to kind of learn from each other that there are many ways to look at beauty.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Journalist Julia Savakul is our guest this afternoon. She's the articles director for Fitness Magazine, and she's the author of The World Has Curves, The Global Quest for the Perfect Body. We have about 5-6 minutes left in this portion of the program. Listeners, if you'd like to join us with a phone call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take another call, a listener on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. You can hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Good. Two comments. One, I'd say was from Professor McKinnon, and two, I don't know if you're familiar with Yoga Journal. It's a magazine that's been around for about 20, 30 years or so. Started out as a California publication, and it's morphed into, speaking of female beauty and so forth, the ads for so many of the products are shown by relatively what I would call probably what you would call the Hollywood body. And there's even a taste, artfully done lady in a nude posture, complicated yoga postures, advertising, I forget what. And it's kind of moved in a, kind of reminds me of Vanity Fair, Cosmopolitan ads and so forth. And that's my, and I've dropped my subscription to it, but I'll just hang up and listen. I thought I'd comment that way. Thank you.
Okay. Julia?
Hmm. I'm not sure what the exact question was, but he seems to have been disturbed by the nudity. Is that...
I would say that maybe a change in editorial focus and advertisements featured in this particular magazine that he had been a subscriber to.
I'm not as familiar with yoga journals, so I'm not. I prefer not to comment on that.
Okay, all right. I want to talk before we are out of time about a woman that you write about in the book, The World Has Curves, and her name is Mia Li, and she's a young Chinese woman. I think she's in her 20s. Very interesting. And this is in a portion of the book you talk about plastic surgery in China. And plastic surgery in China is for the very wealthy. And for Mia Li, she says, you know, there's an appeal for her in some of these procedures, but she's not totally sold on it. What's at stake for someone like Mia Li?
Well, China is fascinating. Right now, there's a very small, very, very wealthy group of young people, young professionals, both men and women in China, and the women see cosmetic surgery as the most flagrant, obvious way to show you have money, because look, I've had my nose done, look, I've had my eyes done. They are not, you know, in our culture, it's sort of hush-hush, you know, you went away and you came back and you look a little different, but, you know, it was really all the hard work at the gym, it wasn't that tummy talk. And in China, there's a real pride for this certain group letting people know you have enough money, because these procedures, many of them cost 4 or 5 times the annual salary of the average Chinese person. So to be able to get one of them really says something about the kind of cash you have on hand. And I think for the average young Chinese woman like Mia, you're caught, because you want to show that you are part of this growing, young, successful, educated group of Chinese people, where they're open to ideas about capitalism, they're open to other cultures, and much less closed off than their parents' communist regime that their parents grew up under. And yet, you know, it's a disappointment to your family to change yourself. It's saying that, you know, your heritage is not good enough. So, you know, I really felt for her in talking to her, and the kind of conflict of how do I show I've made it? How do I show that I'm a success among my peers, when I also want to respect my history and my family? And I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens as more and more Western companies move into the country and more money is available to more young people, because right now, again, you're talking about a very select group that can afford this. It's going to be an interesting road, see which road they choose to take.
Yeah. At the end of her account, she says, the tension between the rich and the poor is enormous. In this kind of environment, everyone is looking for an edge. So if being beautiful means you'll make more money, women are not shy about doing whatever they can to improve their odds.
Yeah, and there's substantial research that shows in Chinese culture, the women who've had these plastic surgery procedures, regardless of education level, are statistically able to get better-paying jobs. That the ones who are able to make themselves look Western, although if you ask them, they'll deny up the wazoo that they're trying to look Western or European or Caucasian, and yet, you know, the double eyelid surgeries and nose procedures, they're all very Western. They're pursuing very Western aesthetics, but that in doing so, the end result, sadly, is that it improves their salary.
Mm. One last question here, and we've got to wrap it up, and that is, what about women across the world who cover themselves as part of their religious practice? Do they struggle with these questions?
But that sort of brings it back to your comment about how much women perhaps just some sort of instinctively or something in us makes us love to shop and texture and how something feels and looks, and that there's a pleasure sort of innate in being female in that pursuit. And I spent a decent amount of time talking to Afghan women who, under the Taliban, obviously were covered head to toe in burqas, and many still are. And what is fascinating to me is that despite this complete body being sort of completely enshrouded in this material that you can't see through, you can't see the woman behind it, they still have a very strong sense of beauty and wanting to take care of their bodies and wanting to look good. And often the only time they uncover themselves other for than for their husbands is in the presence of other women. And they will get together and you know, bring their often homemade beauty products. It's a lot about the face and makeup application. They don't tend to separate face from body the way we do in Western culture. The whole beauty is this whole big package. But simply covering yourself and not having access to Western magazines, media, TV, all of those things that we tend to think influence our pursuit of the ideal body, it doesn't stop them from talking about beauty, what they think is beautiful, wanting to feel beautiful. I think there's something very deep in us that wants to feel good, and good meaning beautiful.
And one last question, and this is something we've kind of walked around a little bit, but we've gotten another email question, and this has to, the question goes to the issue of health. You know, our ideas of thin is healthful, the listener, you know, says, you guys haven't talked about health, cardiovascular health, brain health, et cetera. Anything you'd like to say there?
I mean, you know, in my perfect world, we're moving towards an ideal that is about health, meaning fit, meaning that it's not enough in American culture anymore just to be skinny, because you can be skinny just by, you know, not eating or not eating the right foods and sort of dieting your way to the certain size, but to be strong and to be toned. I think that there's, as I said, an emphasis on that with some of the new television reality shows that hopefully will have a positive effect on our culture. And, you know, again, it's kind of a status thing. How, you know, how hard can you work? How disciplined can you be to have a fitter body? And I think fitness being tied into a healthy body as opposed to simply a skinny one.
And there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Julia, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Julia Savakul is the author of The World Has Curves, The Global Quest for the Perfect Body. The publisher is Rodale.